Good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Mr. Edward Klein. He's written a fascinating book called The Truth About Hillary, What She Knew, When She Knew It, and How Far She'll Go to Become President. Now, the book to me is important because Hillary Clinton may well be the next president of the United States. And the way things are going today, she's certainly positioning herself to run for the presidency, although she says she's not going to. Why, you know very well that she's not telling the truth, because she really hasn't told the truth about much of anything through the years. And Mr. Klein has done a wonderful job of cataloging her history, of talking to so many people who knew her and knew her very well. And most of them, well, they didn't seem to have too high an opinion of her, did they, Mr. Klein?
Please call me Ed, Dr.
Okay, Ed.
And you're right. No, they did not have too high an opinion of her.
Now, my understanding is that your book is really rather controversial. In fact, you had a number of television interviews all lined up. Would you mind telling our listeners a little bit about that?
Yes. This is my fifth best-selling book. And in the first four of them, I have been asked repeatedly to be on most of the television shows that your listeners are familiar with, the Today Show, Good Morning America, Larry King, CBS Morning News, the Fox and Friends, and all kinds of, even The View with Barbara Walters. And this time around, I was booked by these same shows, or many of these same shows, to be on as well. But when Hillary heard about this, she unleashed a barrage of phone calls through her own office and through her supporters, demanding that these television networks cancel my appearances, and if they didn't, that there would be some kind of a retaliation in terms of the access they'd have to Mrs. Clinton. And as a result, these TV networks all canceled my shows, to my utter amazement.
Well, I'm not amazed at all. In fact, I'm just so pleased, though, that you are getting onto talk radio and getting your message out that way.
I am, and it's wonderful that the networks and the mainstream media no longer monopolize the message that gets to the American people anymore.
Well, now, what is it about your book that makes it so different? Because ordinarily, you know, we do not find such an intentional effort to block information getting out. What is it about your book and what you reveal about Hillary that she's so frightened of getting out to the American people?
I think there are a couple of things at work here. One is that I am not a member of the so-called vast right-wing conspiracy. I'm not a well-known conservative writer. As a matter of fact, I'm not a well-known liberal writer either. I'm a registered independent and a person who's been a journalist with some very reputable journals all my life. So that's number one, and that gives my book a lot of credibility. The second thing is I think I've simply done more digging and more reporting and more thinking than anyone else has done yet about Hillary, and the result is that the truth, which should make us free, is making Hillary squirm.
We'll be back in just a moment with Ed. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Edward Klein, and he's written a wonderful book about Hillary. And, of course, one of the questions that is asked about Monica Lewinsky, and, of course, Hillary claimed that, oh, my goodness, I had no idea that my husband would be cheating on me. He lied to me. And the point that you make in your book is that really the reason that Hillary got elected senator there in New York was because of Monica Lewinsky and the way she handled that scandal. Would you want to pick up that thought? Because I think it's such an important point.
Yes, Dr. Stan. It was Hillary herself who was really responsible for hiring Monica Lewinsky. In the spring of 1996, Hillary received a phone call from a big Democratic Party donor by the name of Walter Kay asking her for a favor. And the favor was, would you please hire the daughter of a friend of mine? And that daughter's name was Monica Lewinsky. So Hillary called the Democratic National Committee and asked them to hire Monica, and they did, as an unpaid intern at the White House. And when she showed up, Monica, at the White House, she found that Hillary had, from the very beginning of the Clinton administration, stationed outside the Oval Office one of her chief aides, whose primary responsibility was to keep an eye on the president and his predilection for women. And in fact, this aide's nickname was Mother Superior, because she was acting like a Mother Superior. It became clear to Mother Superior that Monica and the president were up to no good, and she told Hillary, and they transferred her to the Pentagon. This happened in 1996, in the spring of 1996. It was in 1998 that the Washington Post broke the scandal of the Monica Lewinsky being in the Oval Office with the president and the stained dress and all of that. Hillary went on television and told Matt Lauer on the Today Show that she believed her husband when he said that he didn't have an affair with Monica, and that it was all a vast right-wing conspiracy, which was a total lie because she had known about it for 2 years. And then she went on to say a few months later that he confessed to her and she was shocked by his confession, which was also a lie. And then finally she tried to convince the American people that she and her husband were estranged over this, when in fact they were...
Hold that thought for just a moment, please, okay, as we bring our stations back on. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Stephen Ed Klein, the book, The Truth About Hillary, What She Knew, When She Knew It, and How Far She'll Go to Become President. And Ed was simply saying that Hillary had known, for a long time about Bill's affair with Monica Lewinsky. In fact, she had a woman stationed just outside the Clinton's office, known as Mother Superior, and she was keeping tabs on Bill and Monica. And so in 1996, Hillary and Mother Superior had Monica transferred over to the Pentagon. It was 2 years later when the story broke, and Hillary then comes out and said why she had no idea. And then when she did learn that it really was true, how estranged she was from Bill, and then, of course, her whole history, she knew about all of the philandering and all of the women, and she had kept track of all of Bill's infidelities. So this was nothing new at all, was it, Ed?
No, it wasn't new. But what was new, Dr. Stan, is that the polls that the Clintons always took very frequently started showing that there was a lot of sympathy for Hillary as the wronged woman, that people felt sorry for her and that they saw her as a victim of this whole Lewinsky scandal and her husband. And as a result, she suddenly became, within a matter of a few weeks, wildly popular. And it was this popularity, this transformation from a unpopular, scandal-scarred First Lady to a victimized, quote-unquote, popular First Lady that allowed her to run for Senate in New York and win.
And I think it's really so interesting just to go in the background of Hillary, and she's not at all what she appears to be. In fact, you comment that Bill actually found out that Hillary was pregnant by reading the newspaper. She leaked the story to the newspapers back in 1979 before she told her husband.
That's right. Bill was sitting there in the governor's mansion in Little Rock reading the paper, and he called a friend up and said, "You'll never believe this, but this is the first I've heard of it, but Hillary has just announced to the press that she's pregnant."
What sort of a marriage is this?
Well, exactly. I mean, that's why I tell this story in my book, because it really explains the truth about this marriage, which is, of course, that it's a marriage of convenience and political partnership, not a true intimate marriage in the eyes of God.
And certainly you go into the background of Hillary as a student at college, and the fact that many people felt that she was even more than a feminist, that she had some lesbian tendencies?
Well, it's hard to say because, you know, these things are very private, and I can't pretend that I was in the bedroom, so I don't pretend. But there's no doubt, according to her classmates, that Hillary was extremely interested in and studied very thoroughly the whole idea of the lesbian agenda while she was there in Wellesley College, that two of her roommates were, in fact, lesbians, that she adopted many of the lesbian political attitudes of the time. And whether or not she herself is a practicing lesbian, I can't say, whether she's bisexual, homosexual, heterosexual, for that matter, asexual, which may be likely. But we do know that she has embraced this radical gender feminism that is part of the lesbian agenda.
And, of course, the marriage to Bill really was sort of an unusual marriage. She wouldn't even take his name. And wasn't that sort of a problem for him, running for political office, when his wife wouldn't accept his name and wouldn't dress up like a woman?
It was certainly a huge problem. And it was this lesbianism began to haunt her in Arkansas, because when he ran for re-election and his opponents started talking about the fact that Hillary Rodham wouldn't even take the governor's last name, and that she dressed like a lesbian, spoke like a lesbian, because she was she was notorious for using foul language and behaved like one, and many, many voters thought she was. And as a result, Bill Clinton's campaign manager asked her to, you know, speak out about this and deny it, and she refused to do so. It was only after he lost that she finally realized she had to do a complete makeover, which she did, and emerged 2 years later as Mrs. Bill Clinton, dressed up, hair fixed up, and speaking in a much more feminine way.
So basically, it was really all a matter of image. Everything is a matter of perception, and really, when you're running for political office, the idea of a happily married family, a happily married couple, is so important, whether there's any real truth to it or not.
Well, that's exactly right. It's all image making. You know, they, again, getting back to these polls, the Clintons are poll obsessed, and sometimes you wonder whether they have any core values. I happen to think they do have core values, and I think those values are hard left values, very, very extreme left-wing values. But they often hide those values that they really believe in under the charade, or masquerade, I should say, of being a centrist and a moderate.
Now, of course, isn't Hillary really the driving force behind Bill's political career? Isn't she the one who's really sort of organized things behind the scenes to propel him forward?
Yeah, see, Bill Clinton lost his first election to the Congress in 1974, and was wondering whether he would even continue in politics. And it was Hillary who more or less made it plain that if he wasn't going to be in politics, she wasn't going to be in Arkansas with him. She was going to leave him. And when he wondered about running for governor again, she said, if you don't run for governor, I will. And when he tried to run for president the first time around in 1988, she was the one who was egging him on because his chief of staff was saying, no, it's too soon, and these stories about his womanizing are to come back to haunt him. We've got to clean up this business of all these women and intimidate them to be quiet. So Hillary has been pushing and pushing and pushing for a bill to become president, and was really the iron in his spine.
Now, didn't she sort of have organizations for demonizing and attacking and vilifying and frankly destroying anybody who threatened Bill?
Yes. There was, I'm sad to say, a great deal of thuggery in Arkansas on Hillary's part. Anyone who dared speak out against Bill Clinton, especially the women who he abused, were frequently found themselves in a position where they were being literally threatened, physically threatened, and threatened with loss of jobs, loss of careers, exposure as loose women. People who came to investigate Bill Clinton's tenure as governor were often intimidated by these thugs that were loosed upon them. And there was a great deal of physical and psychological intimidation of their adversaries.
And certainly we know how she treated the people in the travel office and really how she treated the people in the White House. It was almost like everybody was dirt under her feet. And right. if they got in her way, she would destroy them. And she certainly destroyed the head of the travel office for no reason at all, and even had him indicted without any basis at all, and ruined his life.
One of the stories that's never been told, and I didn't have room for it in my book, is that during the primary campaign in 1992, the Clinton campaign ran short of money, and they took out a loan from Harry Thomason and his wife Linda Bloodworth Thomason. These are the producers from Hollywood who produced Hearts of Fire and other well-known television shows and made a lot of money. And when the Clintons then took over the White House, Harry Thomason came to them and said, you know, I happen to have, in addition to my TV production company, a travel agency. And I think it would be very nice, since I can do just as good a job as the travel office in the White House, if you would throw me that business. And they owed him big time for that loan. And that was the reason behind Hillary's order to fire the travel office.
Yeah, but to get the head of it indicted, you know, for criminal activity, that was really rather crude. Why not just fire him rather than try to destroy him?
Well, because she always tries to destroy people who cross her. She's tried to do that with me in this book, The Truth About Hillary. She's had me attacked on all kinds of very disgusting levels, which I don't care to go into.
Well, I heard at least one of your interviews with someone, and I thought it was the way they treated you was very uncalled for. And even if when I have dedicated people on my program I totally disagree with, I always try to be nice to them, and this fellow wasn't nice to you in the least bit. You handled yourself very graciously, though.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Dr. Stan.
Well, and of course, what about this use of illegal drugs? And perhaps we can get into that when we get back here in just a minute. But this is fascinating investigative journalism. Mr. Ed has done a tremendous job of talking to people and documenting his conversations. And an awful lot of people are willing to talk because they feel, as I do, that our country is in real jeopardy looking down the line to 2008. And perhaps Hillary's ascending to the presidency of the United States. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Ed Klein. We're talking about his book, The Truth About Hillary, and what she knew, when she knew it, and how far will she go to become the next president of the United States. Now, one of the most interesting things and perplexing things about the Clinton administration was the strange death of the Vince Foster. And you commented in your book how Hillary actually violated the law. The certainly Vince Foster's office was a crime site, at least part of the crime site. He had a lot of papers in there. And she sent her people down to rifle through the files there to get out things that might be incriminating for her that the police otherwise would have picked out. So do we have any idea what she wanted to hide, how she was able to get away with that? And there were many, many questions about the death of Vince Foster that really didn't quite add up.
Well, that's true. We still don't know to this day for sure that, number one, he committed suicide, or was he murdered, or number two, was the body moved from one place to another. What we do know, however, is that for 2 days after his death, Hillary ordered some of her closest advisors to seal the office, Vince Foster's office, from the FBI and the National Park Service police, while they cleansed the office of presumably incriminating material. What was that material? It's hard to say. It certainly must have had something to do with the Whitewater investigations, various Whitewater investigations, various use of FBI files, IRS documents that the Clintons used against their, you know, the tax returns against their enemies. There was a lot of evidence that had been collected regarding the use of prisoners in Arkansas, back in Arkansas, to donate blood for a few dollars, even though these prisoners were known to be HIV positive and had hepatitis C, and that this blood from the Cummins Penitentiary in Arkansas, while Bill Clinton was governor, this blood was distributed to various countries around the world and used for hemophiliacs. And in Canada, there is a huge lawsuit pending even to this very day as a result of the deaths of well over 1,500 hemophiliacs who had transfusions with this blood. It is my belief that among the incriminating documents are documents regarding this blood program in Arkansas.
In fact, one time I actually interviewed a fellow who'd written a book about that, the whole escapade, and he wouldn't use his own name. He was frankly afraid for his life after writing that book. So, you know, going into the background, because you're talking about the murder of those hemophiliacs, they knew the blood was tainted, and the hemophiliacs had to have it so they wouldn't have blades. And they simply killed them there, as they did the same thing in Japan, they did the same thing in France, but nobody has ever been held responsible, although there is a massive lawsuit on that.
Yes.
All right, fine. Well, then, of course, then the question comes up. There were always sort of rumors, and they were always just rumors, that there might have been some special relationship between Vince Foster. Hold that line. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we've been talking about Hillary. We've been talking about the death of Vince Foster. And it was suggested that there were many, many things that Vince had in his files that could have been very embarrassing to the Clintons, perhaps records of Whitewater, records about the blood that had been taken from prisoners in the penitentiary in Arkansas and sold up in Canada that had killed 1,500 hemophiliacs and infected an awful lot of people with HIV and with hepatitis C, and they knew the blood was infected and was sold up there, and Vince Foster apparently was worried about that. He was worried about a lot of things, but then, of course, he dies under very, very strange circumstances. Hillary refused even to let the FBI into his office until they cleansed the office and gotten all the records out, and, of course, this is totally illegal, but then These people are the president and the co-president of the United States. And then I raised the question about the strange relationship between Vince Foster and Hillary. We've heard all sorts of rumors. What did you learn by talking to people who knew about the relationship between Vince and Hillary?
Well, a couple of things. One is that it was an open secret among Hillary's circle of friends that she and Vince Foster were lovers. And it was just taken for granted that that was the case. So there was, it was not even a secret in Little Rock. However, that didn't, I was puzzled by that because it didn't seem to fit in with my profile of Hillary as either asexual or bisexual or a lesbian. And I wondered about that, and it, I came to the conclusion that since Vince Foster was used by Bill Clinton as essentially his enforcer in Arkansas, somebody who would go around making sure that people were towing the line, that it is not inconceivable that Hillary's relationship with Vince was in aimed at keeping him on the string. Apparently he was besotted by Hillary. It's very hard for me to believe that she was besotted by him, because I don't think Hillary is besotted by anybody. And I think that somebody who is obsessed with her as he was would be an easy prey for her if she kept him, as I say, on the string, sexually and otherwise. And I think that may be what explains that relationship.
All right. Under any circumstances, why Vince dies under very, very strange circumstances, and a lot of people who knew things about that were intimidated by the FBI, and apparently there were people within at least some government agencies that were going along with intimidating and threatening people, anybody who wanted to get to the truth of what really happened with Vince Foster. And we may never know the truth about that. So there were really so many strange scandals that beset our nation during the years when Bill and Clinton were in the White House. Now, you talk about how Hillary abandoned lifelong friends and political allies in an effort to moderate her liberal image and to make herself more acceptable for the coming race for the presidency in 2008. What's the background there?
Well, the background is that before her liberal supporters understood what she was up to, which is, as I say, this masquerade as a centrist, they thought that Hillary was abandoning them and actually refusing to, for instance, back certain bills that they wanted her to vote for. And a group of women that, whom I interviewed told me the stories of how they went down to Washington to urge her to vote for a child welfare bill, and she refused to do so because she said it wasn't going to pass. They said, well, we don't care if it passes or not. We want you to stand up for it the way Teddy Kennedy would stand up for it. And she got very upset with them and stormed out of the room. But now it seems to me that more and more liberals have wigged on to, if that's the right phrase, have caught on to what she's up to and are not quite as upset with her as they were at first when she got into the Senate. They realize that she is playing a game here, that yes, she has turned her back on her far left wing stance on so many issues. For instance, she's pro-war, Iraq war. They can't stand the Iraq war, the liberals, and other things. But now that it's become clearer and clearer to them that she's doing this in order to make herself more acceptable to the larger electorate, I think they're beginning to learn to accept it.
And of course, she's doing what Bill Clinton did, to project himself as a centrist, even though he was on the far left. That's, and he did it very successfully, really.
Exactly.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Ed Klein. Fascinating book. We think the book is well worthwhile getting and well worthwhile reading. The Truth About Hillary, what she knew, when she knew it, and how far she'll go to become President of the United States. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is Ed Klein, and we're talking about his book on Hillary Clinton. Fascinating read, fascinating insights into a very, very intelligent, very capable, but very, very ruthless individual. Now, one of the stories that you tell is about her relationship to Mrs. Arafat, Yasser Arafat's wife, and all the problems this created, and then how she managed to placate the Jewish population of New York City after pictures were taken of her hugging the wife of the head of the Palestine Liberation Organization. That was a fascinating story. Would you like to repeat it?
I'd be delighted. Hillary needed the Jewish vote in New York City, as does every Democratic candidate, to offset the Republican vote, the Jewish Democratic vote, to offset the Republican vote from upstate New York. And she was having a lot of trouble with the Jewish voters. And then when she showed up at Mrs. Arafat's speech, and Mrs. Arafat claimed that Israel was purposely gassing Palestinian women and children, and then Hillary, after the speech was over, applauded and went up to the podium and hugged and kissed her, Hillary was in jeopardy of losing that Jewish vote. And so suddenly she turned up a long lost great grandfather who she claimed was half Jewish and laid claim to some Jewish relative, this great great grandfather, as a way of trying to ingratiate herself with Jewish voters.
Now, you had another story here that about she was running against, of course, Rick Lazio, I guess that was the Senate campaign?
Yes.
And, of course, how she leaked this story about illegal stock transfer, no truth to it at all, but, of course, then he had to defend himself against a false charge. What was that all about?
Well, Hillary used controller of New York State, who is a very close ally, Democratic ally of her, H. Carl McCall, to use his letterhead, his official letterhead, to write the Securities and Exchange Commission demanding that the SEC investigate her opponent, Rick Lazio, for some kind of stock fraud transaction. H. Carl McCall also sent a copy of this letter to the New York Times, which naturally printed it, because that would hurt Hillary's opponent, the Republican. And this put, as you said, Rick Lazio on the defensive for the remainder of the campaign, and he was only cleared of any wrongdoing after he lost the campaign.
Well, that's on.
Too late.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. We were just telling about some of Hillary's dirty tricks during the Senate race, where she got one of her friends to write a letter on his letterhead asking the Securities and Exchange to investigate Rick Lazio, who was a Republican opponent. No truth to the story at all, but with the help of the New York Times, which of course is part of the liberal establishment, they were able to besmirch the name of her opponent, draw attention away from what the real issues were, and eventually, of course, Hillary became the junior senator from New York. Now, Chris, she's used these sort of tricks down through the years for all sorts of purposes. And you talk in your book a little bit about how she was actually involved in the original Watergate investigation. Would you like to cover that a little bit? Because that was, of course, when they were going after Richard Nixon. And how did she fit into that so many years ago?
In 1974-75, Richard Nixon was being investigated, as you know, for impeachable offenses. And Teddy Kennedy hoped to capitalize on this by running for president in 1976 after Nixon had been weakened. And Kennedy was able to organize his allies from his brother's administration, John F. Kennedy's administration, to actually staff the House inquiry, impeachment inquiry. And one of the young lawyers who was on that staff was Hillary Rodham, who had been sent down to Washington by one of Teddy Kennedy's chief lieutenants. And when she got down there, Hillary's job was to come up with regulations that would prove that a president does not have the opportunity to cross-examine witnesses in an impeachment inquiry. And the reason for that was everyone on the Democratic side was afraid that Nixon's counsels, his attorneys, would cross-examine witnesses and prove that previous presidents, including John F. Kennedy himself, Teddy's brother, was far, guilty of far worse crimes and misdemeanors than Nixon, because Kennedy had, of course, okayed the assassination of foreign leaders as a method of foreign affairs. So Hillary was involved in that. She was also involved in Teddy Kennedy's strategy to keep Nixon in office as long as possible, twisting in the wind, losing support, weakening the Republican Party. It was only the Republicans who finally convinced Nixon to resign, because they needed to rebuild the party. But Hillary learned her dirty tricks early on in Washington during this Nixon impeachment inquiry.
And I really thought it was so interesting that you mentioned in one of the other programs that it was basically Senator Barry Goldwater who went to Richard Nixon and said, you know, you've got to resign, otherwise you'll destroy the Republican Party and make it obvious that the Democrats will take over everything in 1976. That was pretty smart on Goldwater's part, and at least from Nixon's point of view, he did, at that point, I think, the right thing for the country, don't you?
He did the right thing for the country, and I don't think he would have been impeached myself, but maybe he would have been. But you know, Nixon had a lot more conscience than Bill Clinton when it came his time to face impeachment. And he fought it tooth and nail, despite the fact that he had disgraced the office of the presidency.
And I think it's amazing he was able to survive the impeachment, and had it not been for a lot of help from some senators, even from some Republican senators, why, of course, he would have been thrown out of office.
And that's right.
All right, well, now, of course, there's so many stories that you tell about Hillary. The book is just really almost leads like a mystery novel in many respects, and the way you sort of build up. And one of the things really was so shocking is the fact that everybody in the White House that she came in contact with was afraid of Hillary. She'd make their lives miserable, and she, her language apparently would make even a sailor blush.
That's true, It's interesting that, you know, Hillary in public is this person who likes to present herself as someone in whose mouth butter wouldn't melt, but in fact, in whose mouth four-letter words come streaming out on a regular basis.
But they point out that she really will destroy her friends. I mean, she really has no permanent... no permanent friendships. If one of her friends gets in the way, she destroys them just like she'll destroy anybody else.
That's true. And people who have seen this happen are intimidated by watching the way Hillary has destroyed a whole slew of people in Arkansas and in Washington. And I'm sure she will continue to do this if she's ever elected president.
Well, now, you point out that Bill Clinton was really very, very protective of her, and you even you had an opportunity to talk to George Stephanopoulos?
Yes, I have.
And he seemed to be really very, 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 very candid with you about Bill's willingness to protect Hillary from criticism.
Yes, I think that's true, and I think one of the reasons for that is that Bill really has never been able to handle Hillary. He's afraid of Hillary. I think she intimidates him. And part of the reason for that is that he's constantly walking around with a guilty conscience and doesn't feel that he has a leg to stand on with her. And, in fact, he doesn't.
But, of course, she's put up with all of his infidelities.
Well, that's something that he doesn't seem to get, which is that she's just as bad as he is. He doesn't seem to understand that she's... She's not only has she abided his philandering, she's abetted it.
And I really think that this, in fact, that she's always been there, that, though, to protect him whenever he got into a problem. And really, of course, what she was doing was protecting herself. Now, my understanding is when they got into the presidency, that she wanted to be the attorney general, or she wanted, in fact, she even wanted Al Gore's office. She wanted to run everything in the White House.
Well, that's true. One of the arrangements they had as a result of her coming to his court during the Jennifer Flowers bimbo eruption in 1992 during the primary campaign, when it looked as though his career was over, and she appeared with him on 60 Minutes and supported him.
Is that when everything came crashing down? I'd forgotten the lights came down and the cameras came down.
Yes,
it was almost as if it had been planned that way so that they'd have to stop the interview.
Yes. In any case, she extracted a promise in return from him that if he were elected president, that she would occupy the vice president's office. And indeed, when he was elected president, during the transition, she demanded that office. And when Al Gore and Tipper Gore heard about it, they, of course, went bananas. And they had a big row about this, and Gore won that battle. But Hillary wouldn't give up. She then demanded the job of Attorney General until it was pointed out to her that there was a nepotism clause in the federal statutes that prevented the president from appointing a relative as cabinet member. And then she talked about becoming the chief of staff of the White House, and his political people talked her out of that because it would have been a huge embarrassment if the wife had been chief of staff of the White House. So she settled for an office in the West Wing, but no first lady had ever had an office in the West Wing, which is the policy wing of the White House. They had always been relegated to the East Wing, which is the social wing of the White House. But Hillary demanded an office in the West Wing. She was given one, and she had a huge staff, and that staff didn't have room in the West Wing, so they housed her staff next door in the old executive office building next door to the White House. And it was almost all women, a lot of very manly sort of women, I might add. And that place was called Hillary Land.
Well, you know, one of the things that really bothered me during the Clinton administration was all the people who kept dying under very strange circumstances. And I know you don't go into a lot of that, but certainly the death of Vince Foster, the death of Ron Brown, the death of Jim McDougal when he was in prison. I think there was a list of about 50 or 60 people who died under very mysterious circumstances.
Yes, and there's been a video made of that called the Clinton Chronicles, which you may have seen, and it goes into that at great length. I didn't have room to go into that in my book, and so I didn't have the opportunity to really examine that.
Well, of course, what they did was they planted FBI agents all around Pat Matriciano, who made that film. One of the men he thought was his closest friend was an FBI informant. There were FBI informants working in the office there, destroying the files, and really they literally bankrupted the Matriciano. So the FBI can be used very effectively to target the president's enemies, but that's not what the FBI is for, not to act as a revenge arm for the federal government, and yet that's the reality of what happened, because Matricianos were very close to me, and I was very close to them.
Yes.
So, and I'm sure you know that story. Well,
yes,
I do. As you go into the background of what's going to happen, do you think Hillary's going to be able to pull this off and get the Democrat nomination for the presidency?
Well, Dr. Stan, I honestly believe that she has such a huge campaign chest already built up and such access to so much money that she has such a large campaign staff already positioned around the country, that she has the enthusiastic backing of so many unions, teachers' unions, and lawyers, trial lawyers, special interest groups, gay and lesbian groups, and also, of course, she has this backing of her husband, and he's a very popular figure on the left wing of the party. given all that, I think she is inevitably going to win, unless there's something that we can't predict that happens between now and 2008, that she will inevitably win the nomination of her party. The big question, of course, is can she win the White House? And I think that a lot of that depends on, number one, what's happening in the world, in the country. Number two, who is the Republicans find? At this point, they don't seem to have an obvious candidate. And three, whether Hillary can tip one or two critical red states into the blue column and garner enough electoral votes to win. I would not be surprised if she lost the popular vote and won the electoral vote.
Well, I hope you are not surprised, and anyway, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens. But
I think that would be a disaster for our country,
right.
I might add.
I do, too. Well, I hope that your book will have an impact out there, and that more and more people will begin to understand. You have a notation on the back of your book, and if I can just read from it, and she's the most unbelievable actress I've ever met, said a woman who's worked for Hillary's Senate campaign. I remember one time as a Women's Leadership Forum event in New York, 30 of us sat around Hillary talking about politics, and she said, you know, I love this organization, not just because we sit around and talk about politics, but because of the bonds of friendship forming around us. The way she said it, people were riveted by her performance, but I'd gotten to know her, and I could tell she didn't mean it. She had this unbelievable ability to be a liar. She is soulless. And that concept, she is soulless. In other words, she has no soul, no... that was a rather frightening statement.
But I think it's true. I think that's why I put it there on the back of the dust jacket. Because I think it's very important in this day and age. You know, Ronald Reagan used the word evil to describe the Soviet Union. And I think, you know, he was roundly criticized for doing so because people don't use the word evil much anymore. But I think when it comes to Hillary Clinton, that word definitely applies. I think she is truly evil, and I think evil is something that we must not have in the Oval Office of the White House.
Well, of course, this is one of the recurrent themes of our program, is there really is evil in the world. A lot of people don't like to accept that, but I think it's true.
I do, too.
You comment she's a wife, but she shows no wifely instincts. She's a mother, but she isn't maternal. She's a feminist, but she rode to power on her husband's coattails. She's strong and assertive, but she has abetted decades of chronic infidelity. She inspires fierce loyalty among her followers, but she frequently stabs them in the back. And that would be one of the things that really is so disconcerting, is that apparently she has no true friends. All she has is, of course, her ambition, and she'll run roughshod over anybody to accomplish it.
Exactly, and this is the definition of an evil person, no question about it.
Well, what sort of response are you getting as you go around the country talking to various talk shows about Hillary? Because I know you're getting quite a bit of play. I know that Newsmax is booking you on a lot of programs, and they're doing a good job, incidentally.
So they are doing a wonderful job.
What sort of response are you getting from the audiences as you speak?
Well, Dr. Stan, I'm glad you asked that question because it gives me an opportunity to say how grateful I am to the conservative grassroots in this country who have responded so positively to this book. And it's the people in the conservative grassroots who have made this book the success that it is, and I couldn't be speaking to you even tonight if it weren't for the fact that there is decency in this country, there are morals in this country, there are people who care about values in this country, and these are the people who have helped make my book a success.
Well, you know, the thing is that the vast majority of people in America are good people, vast majority do have standard values. The vast majority of the people certainly believe in God, and they believe in right and wrong, and they're patriotic, and they love America, and they're very disconcerted about what's going on. But I think many of them really have almost this feeling of hopelessness. I mean, what can you do? It seems no matter what happens, things go from bad to worse.
But we can spread the word, and that's what I've tried to do with the truth about Hillary, spread the word about what is the truth, so that people can rally, share this book with each other, talk about it, and stop her before it's too late.
Amen to that. Well, we're going to just come back. We've only got 3 minutes before the program ends, or at least your segment of it. If you're out there in the listening audience, you'd like to talk to Mr. Klein, we will take one or two calls. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. The book, The Truth About Hillary, it's a great read. It's very well done. In fact, you get started in it, and you really don't want to put it down. We'll be back in just a moment here with a special guest this evening. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Mr. Ed Klein. His book, The Truth About Hillary, and of course it's a bestseller at the present time. It's getting a lot of coverage, and of course this story really begins with the story of Monica Lewinsky, which really, I think, epitomized what was going on as far as the Clinton presidency was concerned. But the most amazing thing to me about the book, and the point I thought Mr. Klein made so well, Ed made so well, was the fact that it was really Hillary that was responsible for getting, it was really Monica that got Hillary into the Senate race, and then, of course, to win in New York, because she was able to convince the American people that she was a wronged wife, and got this tremendous sense of sympathy from the American people. And then she began wearing these cute little pink dresses, and her hair looked so nice. And, you know, she really did such a great job. And then, you know, why don't you pick up that? And then that wonderful picture of Bill and Hillary dancing at the beach after they finally had gotten back together. I mean, talk about the ultimate in hypocrisy.
Well, exactly. Hillary obviously wanted to send a strong visual message to the American public that she and Bill were really a loving couple, which of course they never had been. This was during the Lewinsky scandal. And so they went to an island in the Caribbean, and Hillary arranged for one single French photographer to be able to take a picture of them, she and Bill, as in their bathing suits they slow danced on the beach. Now, that was such an intimate moment, quote-unquote, and yet there was a photographer there. And we know for a fact that it was all manipulation because it was set up by Hillary.
And, of course, as we often say here in our program, reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. And that's what it's all about. She's a master at perception, a master at knowing how to play the emotions of the American people. And, of course, she's had a lot of help from the mass media, hasn't she?
Oh, she certainly has. The liberal mainstream media is so much in her pocket that it has almost become ludicrous to try to find an honest story about her in any of the mainstream media.
Well, I think that they won't find what you've written in your book. I want to thank you so much for being with us again, and we do have you for one more audience. Fortunately, we have three separate audiences during the week and one on the weekend, and we've got your schedule for about all of them. But thank you so very much for being our guest this evening, and thank you very much for writing the book, The Truth About Hillary.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Good night, Ed. Bye-bye.
Good night.
All right, fine. Well, I hope you've enjoyed our interview with Ed Klein. Very revealing. We didn't ask for questions because I wanted to hear what he had to say. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and if you want to understand the media, what's really going on, why, there is a book, it's entitled The New Media Monopoly. It's written by Professor Ben Bagdakian, who is a professor at University of Journalism at the University of California in Berkeley. He's a left-winger. I don't care whether he's left-winger or right-winger. It's a great book. I don't care what a man's political inclination is. because I don't think there's a great deal of difference between the left and the right, the conservatives, the liberals, two parts of the political spectrum. It is all created. It's all manipulated. But the book, The New Media Monopoly, goes into the fact that today five men dominate 95% of the American media, and Professor Bekdekian documents this. These media conglomerates control so many of the local newspapers and ultimately determine what the average American will read, what they will hear, what they will see, and ultimately what they will believe. That's the new media monopoly. Of course, we can recommend the books Mass Control and Mind Control. Both of those books were written by Jim Keith shortly before he met a very untimely end, a death, just before his publisher, the Illuminati Press, had a strange and untimely death. Shortly before his wife, then had his ex-wife, had a strange and untimely death. But the books Mass Control and Mind Control, we think, are very important to explain to you how they are able to control the reality of the American people. We have a great four-tape set on mind control, interviews with people who've looked into the background of the various techniques that have been perfected here in the United States to manipulate and control what the American people think. And then, of course, we have a wonderful book. At least I think it's a wonderful book. It's called Operation Bluebird. It's written by Dr. Colin Ross, who is a psychiatrist who deals with the victims of CIA mind-control experiments. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, the CIA does use mind-control experiments and has destroyed the minds of a certain number of people and created dissociated personalities. Fascinating look into that, and then a fascinating look into Operation Paperclip, when we brought the Nazis over here to continue their diabolical mind-control experiments following World War II. And these are people, of course, who should have been tried at Nuremberg, but they were not. So Operation Bluebird is a fascinating book and gives you the background of so much of that. If you'd like to hear our interview with Dr. Colin Ross, that's in the four-tape set entitled Operation Paperclip. And there you'll hear Linda Hunt talking about the Operation Paperclip, bringing the Nazis to America, Dr. Colin Ross, talking about that, and then 2 hours on how the United States helped the Nazi war criminals to escape to South America. Did you ever have to wonder how Martin Bormann and Klaus Barbie and Adolf Eichmann and Dr. Mengele and 10,000 Nazis were able to escape, and why? No one except a couple of the Jewish organizations were ever concerned, and only Barbie and Eichmann were ever captured and brought back. The rest lived out their lives comfortably in South America, along with a tremendous amount of gold that they had. And there was something called the Rat Line. And with the full help and support of first the OSS and then the Central Intelligence Agency, why we helped smuggle those Nazis out of Europe, and with the help of a certain subversive element within the Vatican, they got down there. We actually have a video, an ABC, I believe it was, of Sam Donaldson, who went down and actually talked to many of the Nazis. This was probably in the early 90s, and they were still alive and well and comfortable, living comfortably there, these mass murderers. But you see, when you understand there is an occult hierarchy that rules the world, that worked very closely with the Nazis, then you can begin to understand why these things happen. There really is, as Ed Klein said, there really is evil in the world. If you haven't seen our latest newsletter, The Occult Hierarchy Part 2, it's up on the Internet at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Or we'll be glad to send you a free copy. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Just ask for the occult hierarchy. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Hale. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls here at Radio Liberty at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us Derek Skousen from World Affairs Brief, and we're going to be talking about the things that are going on, current events, and the things that you should be thinking about. Now, it's very interesting, as you know, today, why there were some more explosions over there in London, but whereas before all of the bombs went off, today, shucks, they just didn't know how to do that. And, well, the detonators went off, but the explosives didn't go off. And wasn't it convenient for the people in Washington, D.C., who wanted to get the Patriot Act of legislation through, that as this was going through the our legislature in Washington, D.C., those explosions go off in London, and everybody says, gee, we've got to have the Patriot Act here in the United States. So that, you know, we can protect you from bombings over there in London. And well, there are a lot of strange things that are going on. Why would the Arab terrorists be so foolish as to just this exact date, you know, first of all, 2 weeks ago, corresponding with a group of eight meetings there in Scotland, so that the press didn't stay to find out what happened at the group of eight. They came down to London to follow the bombing there, and then of course we have this incident over here in the United States, but the bombs really aren't very good bombs. I guess they forgot how to make them go off during this last 2 weeks. What are your thoughts on that, Derek?
Well, you know, we're still learning a little bit about that, but we're still kind of watching the news stories as they come out regarding those four London bombs. I think what it reminds me of a little bit is kind of the wave of aftershock, so to speak. When you have an earthquake and everyone gets shaken up a little bit, but then there's a few waves of little mini aftershocks that happen afterwards, and it keeps everyone imbalanced for an extra amount of time, and just goes to remind them and kind of sink in an extra little bit about what that initial shock did. And so that's kind of what these bombs feel like. They feel like little aftershocks after a big earthquake. And it also reminds me of the anthrax attacks right after 9/11, where basically you had a very big deal, kind of a terrorist event, and then afterwards you had kind of this little series of mini terrorist events that didn't seem to really affect a large number of people at the same level, but it kept the terrorist concept in the news and heightened it and kept that hype longer than it normally would have. And so that's kind of what I see is going on here with this particular thing, is it's making sure that the London bombings don't fade out of people's minds.
And is it so interesting, of course, we know that Dick Cheney knew or suspected there was going to be an anthrax attack, because he and the entire White House staff, at least those who worked for him, all went on a very dangerous antibiotic, Cipro, specific for anthrax. So if they knew or suspected an attack was coming, why didn't they tell anybody else? Why did they protect themselves and take Cipro for 6 weeks, but nobody else knew what they were thinking? And why would they even think of an anthrax attack unless, gee, it's amazing the FBI has never been able to figure out where that military-grade anthrax came from. We're going to be right back here in a moment with Derek Skousen, and I think his analogy is very, very telling, very accurate. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Derek Skousen from World Affairs Brief. So pick up the story, Derek, and I really like your analogy.
Well, so what we were talking about is how these spore bombs, you know, are really designed to mirror the original four bombs that went off in London previously, just in terms of the way that they were set off, the placement of them. One of them on a bus, three of them on the subway, as I heard it. I'm actually still hearing things come out about that, but the fact that it just seems to mirror those London bombings in a somewhat more subdued way. In the fact that they fizzled, they didn't go off, they didn't kill a lot of people, but what it definitely did do is it made sure that the terrorist concept could not leave people's mind, that it kept the story going. It kept on giving things. I mean, think about what I was planning to talk about today when I made my notes earlier. You know, I was planning to talk more about Iraq and Abu Ghraib and those kinds of issues, and I think we'll still get around to that. But here I am, right at the beginning, we're addressing the London bombings again and those kinds of issues. So it's this, you know, there's definitely a technique going on here by who's ever putting setting these bombs off, who's ever handling the execution of this strategy, so that what happens is the concept of terrorism, and that an invisible terrorist boogeyman is out there, and it keeps both the people, you know, churned about this issue, as well as all of the legislative and governmental steamrollers churning in their own way, and with a heightened sense of urgency and backing,
and
that
just,
are going to roll over our rights.
And of course, they have to get that Patriot Act through in America. And of course, Tony Blair is doing the same thing over in London. Tony Blair's popularity, sagging popularity, really soared after the London bombing. And now, of course, the English people are quite willing to accept giving up all of their freedom to be protected against those wicked terrorists.
That's right. And so it's key for us to be reminded again and again, as these things happen to us with current events again and again and again, that there is this quid pro quo, there is this pattern, there is this way of managing democracies, way of manipulating people's opinion and people's feelings, people's emotions on a mass scale across all of the Western world, and that this manipulation translates directly into increased power for those who are in power now.
Well, Dr. Stan, back here, our guest is Derek Skousen from World Affairs Brief. Derek, pick up the story from there. And then Derek is basically saying that these terrorist attacks, for whatever reason and whatever the motivation were of the people who set those off, have done one thing, and that is to increase the power of the government of the United States and the government of England over the lives of the people. How could the terrorists have been so short-sighted as to time those bombings corresponding with the Patriot Act there in the United States and a similar act in Great Britain? It was almost as if they were trying to get that legislation passed, which would be used against the Muslim people living in those respective countries, or maybe that's what it's all about. Anyway, what are your thoughts on it, Derek?
Well, it's very clear that, just like you're saying, the timing of these aspects are very key to understand. It's critical to understand, you know, how all of the current events trends are being managed when something like this goes on. Because if you just try and think of, oh, the London bombs in isolation, oh, how horrible, what a travesty, what a tragedy, and don't consider the fact that there are these major political trends that are happening at the same time, where, you know, everyone is in London, all the eyes of the world are on London because London just won the Olympics, because the G8 is there, because the Live 8, their rock concert is there, and everyone is in London, looking in London, and so you have, so seeing all of those stories and how they point to the events leading up to that bombing, and then the bombing happens, and all of a sudden we are reminded about how these events are instantly going to affect the popularity ratings and of George Bush and Tony Blair and their sagging efforts to prop up the war on terror. And as those sagging efforts get propped up, then all of a sudden the legislation machine goes right back into full gear again. And as they do so, it's key to see that there is also this, you know, somewhat of a sub-pattern that we saw kind of in 9/11 and others, where there are these follow-on and aftershock events, so to speak, that make sure that the public opinion is managed to across the time frame needed for the bureaucracies to get into gear and make sure that the legislation gets passed while public opinion is still at its peak.
Okay, well, certainly that this is, in essence, what has happened. And there was a very short-sighted upon the terrorists or whoever planned this, unless, of course, they wanted to get that legislation through.
Well, you know, in terms of, you know, why the bombs fizzled and, you know, why they were, you know, not, you know, they didn't really go off and explode to a certain extent, you know, we've kind of been talking about why they didn't need to, because the bombs already went off last, you know, 2 weeks ago. We just kind of need to keep that momentum going. But I think it's also important to put the whole story together and realize that there is a system, a secret system in place that is placing these bombs, and that people are being manipulated to put these bombs in place. That the so-called suicide bombers were very likely not suicide bombers, but agent provocateurs who were duped into dying and who were not expected to die. That the bombers had timers on them, and the bombers had timers and automatic detonators, which they did again today. The automatic timers and detonators were placed, and yet there was also this semblance of being duped somehow in terms of how those explosions were going off.
Well, I think the important thing is that apparently this is very high-grade military type of explosives, which you don't buy at Harrods there in London. It had to come from a military source. Who was a military source? Who knew how to do this? This is not something the average person knows how to do. This is a very sophisticated operation. The initial one was very sophisticated, but even more incredibly, as sophisticated as it was 2 weeks ago, now, suddenly, 2 weeks later, they can't figure out how to do it. Something's wrong with this whole picture, or perhaps, as Derek said, maybe they didn't need the explosion. All they needed was a few little bangs. But the impression, the impact on the minds of the American people and the British people and the people in Europe was just about the same, just as effective as they'd been major bombs. Even the minor bombs, of course, would have an impact on their minds, creating that aura of fear that, of course, is being orchestrated so cleverly and subtly today.
That's right. It's clever and it's subtle. And some of the things that we've been talking about in the World Affairs Brief over, you know, over quite a long period, actually, as we've analyzed the, you know, both the London bombing and then moving backwards to the other terrorist events going, you know, perhaps we could take it all the way back to Oklahoma City, is that there are a great many indications that that there are groups of highly idealistic people in whether that's you know, ultra right-wing anarchists, or whether they are Islamic fundamentalists, or whether they are Marxist reactionaries. There are small groups of idealistic people who have a pattern of being manipulated by major globalist organizations and major governmental law enforcement agencies, where they get infiltrated and they get fed materials, ideas, strategies, plans, and all of the means and ways, and I get poked and prodded and pushed into doing things that these kinds of idealistic organizations would not normally do. And we see that kind of a pattern emerging as we put together all of the details about the original London bombing and the four bombs that really went off, and how there were four Islamic fundamentalist men who seemed like they were not intending to die in there, but they had been set up to put these bombs in place, and now we're also seeing, you know, the effects further on that all of these bombs are a setup, and these setups are not just done by fringe radical elements alone, but they are done in a controlled manner, that all of these secret so-called fringe terrorist organizations are manipulated, created, and controlled. And this is an overall theme that I think we've been, you know, putting together piece by piece at the World Affairs Brief.
All right. Of course, the question is, who has put them together, who's controlling them, and what is their goal? But that is an entirely different subject. But the one thing is for certain, and that is that we are losing our freedom here in the United States in the name of fighting terrorism.
Yes, that's right. In fact, we are losing our freedom so fast and so rapidly, and with such a, you know, with such a, you know, it's almost like it's planned, one stage after another, one piece after another. You set up the Patriot Act. But you set it up with compromises and sunset clauses and other things. And then, as it goes through, you slowly implement the dangerous aspects of the Patriot Act slowly so that the dangers of that are not immediately visible. And yet as they start to become visible and they start to sunset, then all of a sudden, a new wave of public emotions are manipulated such that those clauses and things can be solidified and strengthened, and the next stage can be grown to break down those. Well, it's not just our rights in and of themselves, but it's also the general public perception of what our rights ought to be, and whether or not we really feel as a culture that it's starting to change, that we're not feeling anymore that we are liberty-oriented across America as a whole, but we should be more security-oriented. And this is an extraordinarily dangerous concept.
And any person willing to give up any bit of their individual liberty for security is entitled to neither liberty nor security and will surely lose both.
And that's such a core fundamental philosophy and such a core fundamental principle that Americans have, you know, somewhere deep down inside, and yet it gets lost in the day-to-day machinations of current events and how that goes on. And that's why I think that it's so key for Americans all over, and you know, anyone who is interested in individual liberty anywhere in the world, to keep an eye on the current events and how they and how they unfold, so that we can start to see and visualize these patterns and the patterns of manipulation and the patterns of occurrences, so that we are not led off down the foggy paths of, you know, of security at the cost of liberty.
And I think that liberty, of course, is in far more danger today, and the danger is not from the Islamic terrorists. It is from the legislation that is being passed to control Islamic terrorism. The only trouble is, if you look at the Patriot Act, not one word about Islamic terrorism. It's not aimed at the Islamic terrorists. It's aimed at the American people.
That is exactly right, and that is critical to understand, that it is about power, and it is about the manipulation of the rights of government and the strengthening of governmental powers and its ability to work on anyone, anywhere, of any kind of persuasion that they choose. The language is being extensively broadened. The excuses and operational activities which governments have always done in secret are now being opened up and becoming part of the standard process.
Amen. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Derek Skousen. And remember that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And much of what you see today is actually illusion and delusion. And you've got to be able to ferret out wherein the truth lies. We'll be asked in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Derek Skousen from World Affairs Brief. I want to go ahead and pick up the story there. Somebody called in and wanted to know if there was any significance to the fact that the first bombing was on the seventh day of the seventh month of 2005. And a lot of people get into all sorts of numerology, and I don't know what to really make out of it. Do you have any thoughts on that, Derek?
Well, other than what you just said, is that... you know, a lot of people mention a great deal about the numerology and how that works. You know, I know very little about numerology. You know, I've only heard, you know, some hearsay things, you know, back and forth. What I do get a picture, though, that the breadth of numerology is so broad, and the scope of it is to such an extent that it becomes very difficult to, you know, for someone like me to say, well, gee, couldn't just about anything be associated with numerology? Couldn't we find, you know, some tie-in for any particular date? And you know, maybe that's true, maybe it isn't. I'm not an expert, and so I can't really answer the question, other than to note that that there are a great many people who know a lot more about numerology than I do, who do keep an eye out for these dates. And as you put those numbers in order, whether it's 9/11 or 3/11 or 7/7, et cetera, how there, you know, I could be convinced that there are patterns there. What's interesting to note is that perhaps those dates are being set up and placed with patterns so that people do pick up on them. It's hard to know whether. You know, everything is done with a certain amount of manipulation in mind. And even whether it's a conspiracy theory that we're talking about, whether it's globalist agendas that we're talking about, or whether it's just radical terrorists doing it on random things, you know, whatever the reason for these aspects, they are all being done to manipulate public opinion at some level. And picking the dates and numbers are part, I think, of potentially manipulating a certain segment of the population.
Good answer. Okay, go ahead. What was the next point you wanted to cover?
Well, we've kind of been talking a little bit at a high level, and I wanted to maybe just bring out a couple of detailed facts of some news stories that maybe not everyone ran across so over the last week or so, since we've been so focused on London and Karl Rove and the Supreme Court nominations, etc. It might be useful to just review real quickly a couple of interesting stories that kind of showed up around the fringe on some of the international websites. One of them is the revelations from a investigative reporter from the New Yorker by the name of Seymour Hersh, who has been slowly uncovering some very specific evidence that the Bush administration has been, in the months before the Iraqi election, deliberately tried to manipulate those elections from a variety of different channels. And it's very interesting to read this particular article by Seymour Hersh that kind of starts to illuminate for those of us who don't really know what goes on in the halls of power.
Hold that thought there for just a minute. Let's bring our other stations right on. Well, this is Dr. Stan and our guest, Derek Skousen from World Affairs Brief. He's coming on a recent article by Seymour Hersh that appeared, as I believe, in the New Yorker magazine, suggesting, and I don't want to offend anybody out there in the audience, he's suggesting the Bush administration manipulated the vote over in Iraq. Could you imagine such an outlandish statement? But then if you read what he has to say, why, it looks like it's pretty obvious. Would our government manipulate the democratic elections? Well, we know that they deposed the Premier Mossadegh in Iran back in 1953, and then we helped to overthrow the Shah in 1979, and we've interfered in elections all throughout the world. In fact, we're trying to destabilize the government in Iran today. why should we even have any question that the Bush administration would try to manipulate this election? In fact, they didn't even let anybody know who was running until 2 days before the election, and we'll pick up the story there.
Well, you know, we've talked before on your radio program, Dr. Stan, about the manipulation of elections and, you know, in Afghanistan or in Iraq and other places where, you know, there's a lot of evidence that shows that manipulation of elections happens to a great extent, you know, even here in the U.S. to a great extent. But what I think is kind of interesting about the Seymour Hersh article is not in the way that it really exposes the methods of or really in the way that it exposes the election fraud on a grand scale, but that it kind of exposes the backroom dealings and how it is that money gets pushed around to start to influence these elections. Because what was going on as the Iraqi elections were starting to warm up is that President Bush was approving a plan to provide covert support to certain Iraqi candidates and the certain political parties that he wanted to see in power. And as part of this plan, we're getting a picture by Mr. Hersh that he's shopping this plan around to get the funding approved in order to provide additional and extra funding to those specific Iraqi candidates that he wants to win. And what it looks like is that particular funding was not able to be approved. The funding for that plan wasn't able to go through Congress. The National Security Council denied that, saying that the administration, the administration then said, well, since Congress denied us this proposal, we'll just take it off the plate. But what Mr. Hersh is uncovering is that there was another secondary channel through which the Bush administration was able to go ahead with those covert election activities in Iraq and had them conducted by retired CIA officers and other non-government personnel.
In other words, they really don't care what our duly elected representatives say. They have an agenda, and they're going to use CIA and CIA slush funds to violate the law.
That's exactly right. They're going to use, you know, CIA slush funds or even ex-CIA people or non-governmental people to have to get these policies implemented. What's key to understand that I think everyone should know is that the arms, the outstretched arms of the administrations and the law enforcement agencies are much, much broader than just the constitutionally defined limitations of their powers,
and
the legal limitations of their powers.
And it's not just this Republican administration, the Democrats have done this. Both political parties do this. In fact, it has nothing to do with political parties. It has to do with who controls the political parties. And, of course, it's this ruling elite or power elite, or call it what you will, that works through the CIA and through the intelligence agencies. They make the decisions. Many times even the presidents are just a figurehead.
That's exactly right. What's going on here, it's very clear, is that the government that individuals in government are working beyond the government to implement their personal policies and their personal preferences to see what's happening. And if they can't do it through government channels, they have all kinds of non-government resources and funds and other things to push these policies through. And so, you know, when they talk about the steamroller effect of the Bush administration or whatever administration, it's much broader than what we might expect.
And, of course, they got the people in office there in Iraq, and shucks, those people say, gee, we don't want the Americans to leave. We don't want you pulling your troops out. We want you just to stay here. Why, just as long as you want to stay here, maybe stay forever. And as long as we stay, they're going to continue to be violence. And that's the tragedy. And nobody ever asks who's financing the insurgents over there. Why, the Syrians are financing them, and they're working with our CIA. And, of course, the Saudis are financing them. Why, they're our good friends. And the Iranians are financing them. And who brought the Iranians to power? Why, your CIA. And they brought the Ayatollah Khomeini to power back in 1979. Well, this is Dr. Stanback here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Derek Skousen from World Affairs Brief. And Derek is saying that, although the American people have told us how wonderful we have the democracy now in Iraq, and we had democratic elections. Derek is suggesting that maybe there was a little hanky-panky going on behind the scenes. Would that be a fair statement?
Well, yes, that would certainly be a fair statement. In fact, there's a great deal of hanky-panky going on behind the scenes. And we saw some of the overt effects of those kinds of things happening when we saw how, for example, the names of the people who were going to be elected in Iraq were held until the last minute. And you can just imagine what kinds of problems that brings into a quote-unquote free election. And yet, what we're also starting to see is that there's a great deal of backroom dealings and backroom strategies and planning for manipulating these elections. Not only that these backrooms and strategies are occurring, but when those strategies and backroom agendas cannot be pushed through the standard governmental and law enforcement and military processes because of the checks and balances of our American system, there are a variety of contractors and outside retired government people or non-governmental organizations who are waiting in line and waiting in the wings to implement these strategies anyway. And so what's key, I think, to understand is that that these agendas are moving forward on a broader scale than a lot of us might see necessarily.
And I just would like to intersperse here or intercede and mention that we wanted people in positions of power in Iraq who would demand that the American forces stay. We really want to keep our troops permanently stationed in the Middle East so we can dominate that part of the world. And so we would make sure that the people who won the election would be the people who would plead with the American government to stay, somehow illegitimate or legitimatizing our occupation of the Middle East. Remember that when the war ended in 1945, we had troops in Germany. We still have troops in Germany now 60 years later. When the war ended in 1945, we had troops stationed in Japan. We still have troops stationed in Japan. And if you honestly think that we're going to pull our troops out of the Middle East, you don't understand the imperialistic programs of the people who work behind the scenes, who intend for America to dominate the world and bring about the new world order, the new world religion, and, of course, the new world monetary system. We'll be back in just a moment with Derek Skousen. Well, Derek, before we go on, would you want to get out your telephone number and your website so people would know how to get in touch with World Affairs Brief?
Yes. The telephone number to get a sample copy of the analysis that we write every week from the World Affairs Brief is a toll-free number. That's 877-518-5888. Again, that's toll-free 877-518-5888. And when you call that, you'll be able to get mailed to you a hard copy sample of the weekly email newsletter that we send out every week, analyzing and bringing together what we think are some of the key stories and what we ought to learn from those key stories about how these trends and strategies and patterns of control and government can be sifted from stories all over the world and how they start to affect us here at a very local level.
Amen to that. Well, I think it's an excellent source of information, and I recommend the World Affairs Brief to you. I go to there just about every day that I possibly can, pull down the articles so that I can be abreast of what's really going on in the world, and it saves me hours of having to surf the web looking for the stories. Fortunately, Derek and his brother and their staff search the web for me every morning, so when I get to it, I have my finger on the pulse of the world.
Well, one of the things that I think is interesting about the concept of worldaffairsbrief.com, you know, even I still go there occasionally, and you know, I'm used to the kinds of stories that show up, but the fact that, you know, kind of bringing them all into one place and seeing them all together, seeing them all in one location as these stories are sifted out, because, you know, well, you can often see them, you know, on the second page of so many newspapers or websites all over the world. But when they're in the context of Britney Spears and Michael Jackson and whatever else, it doesn't have quite the same impact that I think that you get when we, like, when we discuss these things on your radio show of all these stories in one context.
Amen to that. I think you do a great job.
And so some of the other stories that I think we could bring into this context of both the London bombing and Iraq and the G8 and all of these things, you know, to bring all these stories together, they just happened, you know, over the last week or so. But they all kind of play together, and they emphasize some key concepts. For example, there have been some interesting stories coming out about the tie-ins between Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib, and also the officials who were in charge of those particular institutions. We're talking at the general level. We're not talking about the guards who were ultimately prosecuted as scapegoats for those atrocities that everyone in America was horrified by, but the fact that there were policies implemented and are slowly coming to light with some recent stories this week of how those policies were implemented and were approved by the Bush administration directly through Secretary Rumsfeld.
And in fact, they've denied this all along, and now it's coming out that they haven't been telling the truth, that Donald Rumsfeld did approve of these methods of torture that were to be used to humiliate and, of course, to wear down and sleep deprivation and fear from barking dogs and sexual humiliation, knowing that this would, of course, totally demoralize these Muslim men who were so devout in their faith. And yet this was approved at the highest level, and what they do, of course, is they go after the privates and the sergeants. But apparently one of the generals now has been relieved, but nobody's suggesting that Donald Rumsfeld be held responsible, or that the president, who's not fired Donald Rumsfeld, be held responsible.
That's right. But the fact is that the knowledge of what went on, as we are discovering, despite previous denials, we are actually discovering that as the truth comes out, that all of these processes were briefed with Donald Rumsfeld's staff by General Miller, who was over Guantanamo Bay at the time that these were introduced. General Miller briefed Rumsfeld's staff, got the approval, went back and practiced these effects. This was before the Iraqi invasion, and then as Abu Ghraib started to collect a variety of political prisoners, General Miller himself went over with some of his staff and trained the Abu Ghraib teams. And he actually set up some special "quote unquote" tiger teams who were trained specifically in some of these highly degrading interrogation practices, which ultimately, over the next few months, became even worse and became an even more problematic issue, which eventually leaked out onto the web and caused the great scandal that everyone heard about.
And of course, totally humiliated the United States and degraded the United States in the eyes of the world, but also infuriated the Muslim world and many people who had previously supported America, maybe even were very sympathetic with America after 9/11. We lost the high ground, the moral high ground, but we lost the support of good people throughout the world.
That's right. And, you know, we're losing that moral high ground, we're losing that support, we're losing that perception of a certain amount of moral high ground, of good feelings, of good neighborly feelings with countries all over the world. And I'm not just talking about the Muslim world. We're talking about Western Europe and everywhere else. The U.S. is starting to become the bad guy in the eyes of everywhere else in the world. It used to not be so. When I was much younger and had a chance to travel to Europe and other places, it was a young people all over would come up and, you know, and ask about, you know, would think it was cool to talk with someone from America and ask about how things were going on in America. Whereas when my little sister was out there recently, she felt entirely the opposite way, that she was very strongly looked down upon, and it was, you know, did not feel comfortable at all, you know, nearly to the same extent being American out there. So the practices of our administration and how they are deliberately you know, creating some kind of bad feeling all across the world, and it is causing a rise in terrorism, not just in the Middle East, but may in fact continue to inflame the war on terrorism, make it larger, make it grow, make this boogeyman of the war on terror and terrorism even stronger. And that wraps back directly into what we were talking about originally, about the overall pattern and process of how the war on terrorism is used to expand governmental law enforcement powers at the expense of individual liberties.
Amen. I think you're absolutely right. So what's next?
So we talked about Rumsfeld and his prior knowledge of the Abu Ghraib atrocities, and how those how his prior knowledge went all the way back to Guantanamo Bay. We talked about how the Patriot Act is being manipulated by the war on terror. We've talked about how the bad feelings among the Muslim community are making the war on terror you know, even stronger to a level. And there's a very good article written by Ron Paul last week about suicide terrorism in particular, and how the how suicide terrorism is growing dramatically in Iraq. And whereas before the Iraqi invasion by the United States, there had never been a suicide attack in Iraq before. And so what Ron Paul discusses in his again, a very cogent article, is about suicide terrorism and the concept of suicide terrorism and where it comes from. I think it's important for us to step back and look at suicide terrorism from a historical standpoint. And Ron Paul did us a service by bringing to light a book called Dying to Win, written by Robert Pape, which explains the strategic logic of suicide terrorism, where it comes from, what drives people to become suicidal and commit these acts of terrorism in such a dramatic way. You know, is it just kind of a characteristic of Islamic fundamentalism? Well, that's what a lot of Americans are being led to believe, I think. But Robert Pape shows, in fact, that the largest Islamic fundamentalist countries have not been responsible for any suicide terrorist attack. None of them, for example, have come from Iran or the Sudan. But the U.S. invasion of Iraq has caused a tremendous outgrowth in suicide terrorism. That suicide terrorism is big among a variety of secular groups. For example, the Tamil Tigers, the Marxist secular group in India, in Sri Lanka, actually. Suicide terrorism is not directly tied to Islamic fundamentalism, but it is, however, directly tied to occupation and to oppression by a greater growing monopolistic and dictatorial government that is that does not reflect the culture of the country and the ideology of the country where the suicide terrorism starts to fester and engender and then blow up.
I think
that's exactly what we've been seeing.
I think people need to know that everything that's going on is planned. If you go back and read Samuel Huntington's book, The Class of Civilizations, about 1966, I think, 1996, and he tells about the one thing you don't want to do is try to impose your way of life and your values and your moral standards on another country, because you're going to get tremendous resistance. And if the United States or the West was to try to impose their way of life on the Muslim world with 1.2 billion people, this could result in a disaster. disaster. And then in 1997, why Brzezinski, Zygmunt Brzezinski, was the architect of everything going on. Today, he was the one that was behind the toppling of the Shah and bringing the Ayatollah to power, and then, of course, precipitating the Afghan War so that we could begin to recruit the Mujahideen and create the Al-Qaeda movement. The CIA financed this whole movement and actually was encouraging this Islamic radical belief and printing copies of the Quran in Langley and putting out textbooks, that was USAID, pushing radical Islam. And so, but Zygmunt Brzezinski writes back in 1997 his book, The Grand Chessboard, and he talks about, you know, how there will be resistance from the Islamic fundamentalists, but since they don't have a country behind them, it'll be more or less a diffuse violence. And the implications is it will never be able to defeat us, it will simply be a very bothersome. They knew exactly what was going to happen. And, of course, I believe that they knowing what was going to happen, they went right ahead with this war anyway. And they are able to anticipate everything that's taking place long ago.
Exactly. And, in fact, what you were saying about them knowing exactly what was going to happen is one of the key things that I think is worth highlighting today from many of the news stories that we've pulled out over the last week, is that... That Rumsfeld knew exactly what was going on in Abu Ghraib and in Guantanamo, and that this was not just some kind of an accidental thing that happened. The Downing Street memos, which we talked about several weeks ago, illustrate how Britain, you know, made sure that the Bush administration understood what kind of a quagmire Iraq was, and that they knew exactly what kind of a situation that they were walking into and how difficult it would be to extract themselves, you know, even if they did everything right, which they certainly didn't. And so all of these stories point to the fact that the Bush administration knew exactly what they were getting into, and that they knew that every ramification, from whether it was guards treating prisoners in a horrible way, to suicide terrorism exploding in Iraq, it was all predicted beforehand, and they knew that those kinds of things were highly probable things that were going to happen. And yet they steamrolled through that anyway, and in contrast to trying to create structures and plans to avoid these problems, in fact, it seems like plans and structures have been created to exacerbate those problems. And that's what I think is so frightening about this picture overall.
And, of course, we know what happened after the First World War, when Great Britain, trying to create a state of instability in the Middle East, took three warring factions, three warring states, and put them into one nation, the Kurds, the Shia, and the Sunni Muslims. Why? Because they did not want stability there, so they would need to be, they would be needed. Well, now, we have an opportunity to change that. Whether we should have gone in the first place is a moot question at this time, but why not give the Kurds their country, give the Sunnis their country, give the Shia Muslims their country, and just pull out of there? We're not going to do it, of course, because the real reason for the war was so we would have a justification to stay there forever. But if you really wanted to solve the problem, let the people have their autonomy, let them have their own states, stop the warring factions between the various groups, and give the people an opportunity for freedom. Well, I don't think it's going to happen. Do you, Derek?
I don't. We, in fact, we know how to solve these problems, whether it's terrorism in Iraq or whether it's poverty in Africa, and the solutions were the same solutions that allowed America to grow into the great country that it is, in terms of giving people freedoms and liberties. The basic fundamental theoretical principles have been proven, have been established, and we know how to implement those. And yet, in the name of those principles, we are... Our U.S. government is going out and offering what? Well, in the name of those principles, they're offering pain and poverty and sorrow, and it's a betrayal of the very concepts that we know could save the world. And that's what I think is so especially sad about
the... And the thing is, more than that, is the American people are simply going along. Where is the outcry from our Christian leaders, from our conservative leaders, from our Republican leaders? And most of them are just going along to get along. and of course to get the benefits, because if you go along with the administration, you're going to get all sorts of perks and all sorts of special deals, and who knows what else you're going to get under the table. They're bribing our legislators. We've got the finest legislators in Washington, D.C., that money can buy. And it's about time the American understood, people understood, that the reason that our founding fathers gave us a republic and not a democracy was they realized if you had a democracy, you had power in the hands of men, and that power would be misused. That's why they wanted to limit the power of the central authority, so the men could be free. Because they realized that liberty and limited government were synonymous, that tyranny and democracy and total government were synonymous. And do we have limited government? Do we have total government? We'll be back here with Derek Skousen to wrap up this evening's program here in just a moment at Radio Liberty. Well, Derek, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program for us.
Well, thank you, Dr. Stan. I really appreciate the conversation we've had there this evening. I think it's been interesting for me even to kind of emphasize what we believe here at the World Affairs Brief for a long time, that pulling together all of these different news stories and seeing them all in the same context. You know, these are news stories that are out there in standard papers. I mean, papers like the New Yorker, the Washington Times, the Asia Times, the Financial Times, you know, major papers throughout the world, and yet it's so difficult to see these truths and analysis when they're all so disparate and hidden in these pages. And yet what we see when we put them all together, when we put them on the same page, or when we talk about them in the same radio program, is that the stories that are happening today and in the newspapers right at this very moment point to all kinds of patterns of foreknowledge, of planning, and of strategic elements that are causing the pain and the problems and the betrayal of the key ideas of goodness and of liberty and of freedom and of personal individual growth over our lifetimes. The potential there is being betrayed, and they know it is.
I agree with you totally, and I think it's time the American people got the information and then helped us to disseminate it out across America in the time we have left, because if we don't take America back, if there's not a revival in America, if America doesn't turn back to God, I see very little hope for the survival of our republic.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. I think we agree.
Okay, fine. You got 1 minute to wrap up your thoughts for this evening.
Well, I went from 3 minutes to 1 minute.
Right. Well, there's only got 1 minute left. Of course, I'm looking at the computer here. So go ahead.
Well, thank you. Well, thank you. And so the wrap up today is that what we're seeing are these patterns of foreknowledge, these patterns of manipulation, and whether that's the London bombings and about how Islamic fundamentalists were manipulated there, whether it's the whole country of Iraq and a whole nation, and how they are being forced into a very painful situation that explodes into suicide terrorism, or whether it's something which we didn't get to today about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and how that is almost a microcosm of how these forces are coming together in ways that do not solve problems, even though we know how to solve those problems. And so our current events each day can teach us about the patterns of control and the growth of governments that are happening.
We're out of time. God, goodbye. Good night. God bless you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. I hope you enjoy our conversation with Derek. I enjoy Derek and his brother Andrew on our programs. They do a great job for us. And we hope that they, of course, will want to listen on a regular basis and get other people listening. And their material at World Affairs Brief, we have no financial relationship to them. We just think it's a great opportunity to get the information. We go there on a regular basis. So if you'd like to get more information about what's really going on, about the spiritual battle in the world, let me suggest my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or the book or the video or the audio tape. If you want to understand what led up to 9/11, we have, of course, Terror Timeline by Paul Thompson, which gives you almost month by month, week by week, day by day, minute by minute, evaluation of what led up to 9-1-1 and then the aftermath of that. Paul Thompson's book, I think, is certainly one of the best overall books. And then, of course, Jim Marr's Inside Job. And there seems to be very little question of his inside job. He has a wonderful interview there with a woman who was in the Pentagon and walked out through the hole on the side of the Pentagon after the bombing, and then she was approached by the men in black and told to keep her mouth shut, that she is not to tell her story under any circumstances. If there's nothing to conceal, what are they concealing? There were no flames when she came out through the hole in the side of the Pentagon, at least according to her story. But I think, of course, she's afraid to come onto my program, although we've asked that she can. And what you're seeing all across America is many people are afraid to tell what they know, for fear that they'll end up like the 50 people who died so strangely during the Clinton years. There were over 100 people who died associated with the assassination of President Kennedy, and to this very date, why so many of the files of the Warren Commission are still classified. We can't let Lee Harvey Oswald find out what we knew about the assassination. So many of the files for Pearl Harbor are still classified. We can't let Emperor Hirohito know what we knew before Pearl Harbor. Ladies and gentlemen, they're concealing everything from the American people. Probably the best overall assessment of what's going on today would be my talk on the Brotherhood of my talk on the Iraq, the Untold Story. This is, of course, the cause of all the wars of the last century, and the syllabus, Iraq, the Untold Story. That's the DVD or the syllabus. And then, of course, we have the talk on the coming economic crisis and the little pamphlet that goes with that called A History of Money. And you must understand that so much of what's going on today has been planned long ahead of time, and there are powerful spiritual forces at work that are intent upon destroying this country as we've known it, pushing America into a position of preeminence in the world where we will bring about the New World Order, the New World Religion, and lead the world into the cashless monetary system where you'll neither buy nor sell unless you wear the mark of the beast or be known by the number of his name. Now, to really understand anything, everything going on, you need to see our newsletters, The Occult Hierarchy, Part 1 and Part 2. The Part 1 and Part 2 are up on our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. If you would like to get either one of those newsletters, we'll send you one of them. Just give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927, or if you prefer, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. That's like the virus, HIV-WAR, because we are at war. America, our freedom, our future, our families are under attack today. So if you'd like to get a free copy of one of our newsletters, give us a call. And then please go to our website at RadioLiberty.com, and you can listen to our programs there 5 hours a day, directly or indirectly. You can listen to our archive programs after you're through listening to the regular programs, and tell your friends about our program. Encourage them to become informed. If they don't want to listen, that's their problem, but your job is to tell them. And so until tomorrow at the same time, please pray for America. Pray for revival, but pray for Radio Liberty for our provision and protection. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.